The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with something that's a little seasonal. This broadcast will take place on March the 8th, which is 10 days before we get to St. Patrick's Day. And we need to know what Éireann go Breá means. And anyone of us who has a little bit of Irish background will understand that that's the logo on one of the Irish flags, which shows a lady with that's in the form of a harp. We're diving into what exactly Éireann go Breá means and where the common St. Patrick's Day saying came from. Hint, its roots lie in rebellion. Éireann go Breá, and by the way, that's spelled E-R-I-N space G-O space B-R-A-G-H, is a phrase you likely hear as St. Patrick's Day approaches, and other times of the year of your Irish descent. People shout it out with pride while partaking in a celebratory St. Patrick's Day tradition, consisting of raising a beer, of course. But what does it really mean? Similar to the symbolism of the four-leaf clover, the phrase has Gaelic origins, but is also aligned with historical and political instances. What does Éireann go Breá mean? Éireann go Breá is sometimes also spelled Éireann go Breá, B-R-A-U-G-H. Both are an anglicized version of Éireann go Breach, E-I-R-E-G-O-B-R-A-C-H, which literally means Ireland to the end of time. The word Éireann is of Gaelic origin and is Irish word for Ireland. The second part of the phrase is go Breá or go Breach, meaning till the end of time, which has also been expressed as till doomsday. The origins of Éireann go Breá. By most accounts, the roots of the phrase trace back to the Irish Rebellion of 1798. This was when a group of Irish rebels staged an uprising to protest against British rule. Unfortunately, their attempt to garner national support and organize a unified, widespread protest was unsuccessful, and they were defeated in a bloody battle involving many casualties. During the fight, the rebels used this anglicized version, Éireann go Breá, on their banners and flags as a way of expressing allegiance to Ireland. It also served as a rallying cry. One of the earliest appearances of the phrase in the United States was in the 1840s. It was used on an old green and gold Irish flag designed and flown by St. Patrick's Battalion, a unit of Irish American mercenaries and U.S. deserters who fought alongside Mexicans and Europeans against the United States in the Mexican-American War. How do you pronounce B-R-A-G-H? The English pronunciation of Éireann go is exactly the way it's spelled. The Og, A-G-H, in Breá makes an H sound. Put together, it's pronounced Éireann go Breá. Today's use of Éireann go Breá. In modern usage, the phrase is translated as Ireland forever. Most people who use the phrase today likely don't know the historical and political origins of the slogan. It has now become sort of slang, often used as part of St. Patrick's Day pop culture lexicon, shouted at parades or in place of cheers as a toast with a mug of green beer. Still, it is sometimes used by those of Irish descent to express their love for their mother country. Okay, after that short diatribe on St. Patrick's Day, let's talk about something that's a little cleaner. How often should you really shower? How often you should shower is a question with no simple answer. Experts explain when and what to wash in the shower. Shower time. Wellness trends come and go, but one thing that we always assumed was that in style was good hygiene. Now we're starting to wonder, given the topic of showering, or not showering as the case may be, is being hotly debated on social media by celebrities. Quite a few have fessed up and said they have no problem skipping the daily ablutions. One is actor Jake Gyllenhaal, who told Vanity Fair he finds bathing less necessary at times. On Dax Shepard's podcast, Armchair Expert, Mila Kunis and husband Ashton Kutcher said it wasn't really a top priority for themselves or their kids. Meanwhile, actors The Rock and Jason Momoa came out as shower fans on social media and in interviews. Is skipping a shower as gross as it sounds? But even more importantly, does it really have an impact on your health? Well, it can. According to Andy Gonzalez, M.D., a board-certified dermatologist at River Chase Dermatology in Miami. Thanks to buildup dirt and sweat, some consequences of not showering enough include body odor, acne breakouts, dead skin buildup, fungal infections, and oily hair, according to Dr. Gonzalez. Not showering enough can also increase the likelihood of getting sick, she says. Of course, there's nothing wrong with skipping a shower now and then, and there are some risks to overdoing cleanliness and hygiene, too. To find out how often is enough and when it comes to jumping in the shower, we asked Dr. Gonzalez and another expert some questions. Although there's no one-size-fits-all, the pros share their insights to help you determine what's best for your body. What determines how often you should shower? How often you should shower depends on a few things. According to germ expert Philip Tierno, Ph.D., a microbiologist at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, here are some things to consider. Your activity level. One variable that determines how often you should shower is your activity level, according to Dr. Gonzalez. If you are someone who engages in daily in sweat-inducing activities, you will likely need to shower every day, she says. People who exercise regularly should shower regularly, or at very least, freshen up post-workout until they can bathe. However, if you don't participate in any physical activity during the day, it may be unnecessary for you to shower each day. There are a few skin conditions you can get or worsen from not bathing or showering. One is dermatitis neglectica, where you get brown patches on your skin made up of dirt, oil, and dead skin cells. If you hit the gym and opt not to shower, you could also increase the risk of getting an infection. One example is impetigo, a contagious bacterial skin infection that causes red sores. Another is ringworm, a contagious fungal infection that is easily spread not only by skin-to-skin contact, but by touching infected surfaces or objects. The symptoms are scaly red, itchy skin. Plus, the same type of fungus also causes athlete foot, too. Sweat and body odor. Some people sweat more than others, whether or not they participate in physical activity. So similar to how active you are and how much you sweat in general is another way to determine how often you should shower. Some people don't perspire as much and don't have heavy odors, Tierno says, and they could get away with showering less often. A lot of people don't use deodorant of any kind, and they would be more likely to have an odor after a few days, he says. So it would be almost required to bathe at a particular frequency, dependent upon the individual. In short, the more you stink, the more often you need to bathe, and that is if your body odor is a concern to you, and especially to others around you. Skin type. Another contributing factor is your skin type. If your skin is on the oily side and is prone to acne breakouts, showering every day would be wise, according to Dr. Gonzalez. But you should only shower a few times a week if your skin tends to be dry and flaky, so that you don't deplete the oils of your skin further. People with dry skin who shower too often may irritate the skin barrier, leading to even more dryness and redness. Those with skin conditions like eczema or psoriasis may also experience irritation if you overdo showering. If you have a skin condition, your doctor might recommend showering less often and using cool or lukewarm water to avoid irritating your skin. The season. People adjust their showering frequency with seasonal change. The summer brings hot and sticky weather, which often causes body odor, Dr. Gonzalez says. However, winter leads to drier skin. Those living in humid or hot climates may opt to shower more often since they are more likely to sweat, too. How well you clean your butt. Tierno isn't holding back. Cleaning your butt or wiping away as much fecal debris around the anus as possible is an especially important task between showers. And knowing how to wipe your butt will helps people prolong or extend their time between showers, too. The idea is to make sure you wipe their anus in an appropriate way, Tierno says. That's a very important aspect of maintaining good hygiene. Following an initial wipe, considering doing double duty and cleanse the area using wet tissues with either a salt water solution, 1/2 teaspoon to 1 teaspoon and a quart of water, or even a mild soap solution to clean the area well. Anal wipes are also an option, too. This practice isn't a bad idea, even if you do prefer to shower daily. In a pinch, you can use wet tissue with plain water, but plain water shouldn't routinely be used because it can be irritating. So really, how often should you shower? There's no generic rule about how often you should shower, according to Dr. Gonzalez, but mostly comes down to personal preference. Some people feel that showering every day is a must, and some people believe that showering 2 or 3 times a week is sufficient. In general, male or female, it's okay to skip a day or so, depending upon the circumstances, according to Tierno. Alternating between your bathing every other day is perfectly fine, he says. There's no one size that fits all, unfortunately. It's not going to hurt to engage every day or every other day if you choose to, according to Tierno. However, Dr. Gonzalez does suggest showering no more than once a day to keep skin in its healthiness. Focus on cleaning these parts. How often you shower is as important as how well and where you're cleaning. So it makes sense that Dr. Gonzalez recommends focusing on cleaning the dirtiest parts of your body. These areas include the underarms, in between your toes, the groin, the hair, and the breast, says Dr. Gonzalez. Any crevices in the skin should also receive extra attention in the shower, as they get the grimiest and sweatiest, he says. Again, Tierno drives home the importance of cleaning the butt area. People who need to shower more or less often. Since most teenagers participate in physical activities, they are the age group that should be showering most frequently, according to Dr. Gonzalez. Plus, teens beginning puberty experience an increase in body odor. Meanwhile, children and older adults do not necessarily need to shower as often as teenagers to maintain their cleanliness. Of course, individuals who engage in work where they come into contact with debris or germs, such as custodians, garbage collectors, and butchers, may want to shower more often than those who remain in an office all day. The bottom line, when it comes to the right amount of showering once a day or every other day, seems to be the rule of thumb. But remember, more isn't always better when it comes to showering. Overdo it could lead to dry, itchy skin. Tierno's best bit of advice is to remember that you know your body best. Only you can determine exactly how much cleansing your skin tolerates and needs. Now that we've taken care of our hygienic needs, let's take a look at the voice of the average grunt. From World War II to Afghanistan, America's fighting men and women were always accompanied by a familiar friend. After Warren Wedhorn Arps works through his Reader's Digest cover to cover with a Marine's precision, he passes it along to employees at his travel company, which gives tours of military sites around the world. Now 92 years old, Wedhorn first flipped through the magazine in the 1930s in his family's outdoor privy in upstate New York, and he's been passing around his copies of the magazines. He's been passing his copies of the magazine around to others since. He fought in the Korean War, when the ground was too frozen to dig foxhole, but the mail still arrived and always welcomed morale boost. He shared his magazine again in the steamy jungles of Vietnam, where he was awarded the Silver Star for rallying his men to drive back the North Vietnamese troops who had surrounded them. The mail was delivered to even the most far-flung outpost, and if the choppers couldn't land, the crewmen dropped the mailbags out the open doors, and I remember doing that more than once. Throughout it all, said Weedham, who lives just outside of Washington, D.C., I had my Reader's Digest in my pocket. That service members should connect with the magazine is fitting. The idea for Reader's Digest was fine-tuned in the war. The founder, DeWitt Wallace, had joined the Army in 1917. A year later, he was severely wounded during the massive Meuse-Argonne offensive. As he lay in a French hospital for 4 months, recuperating from shrapnel wounds at his neck, back, and shoulders, he read American magazines and practiced trimming down the articles. After the war, Wallace honed his idea for a magazine filled with articles condensed from other publications, one that would blend human interest, advice, and humor, and tackle problems of the day. He couldn't find a publisher to take chance on him, so he and his wife, Leela Atchison Wallace, published it themselves. Since the magazine's debut in 1922, Wallace always made space for pieces about the military. In 1959, the magazine devoted nearly 60 pages across two issues to America's most storied day of battle, with a condensed version of the Cornelius Ryan's book, The Longest Day, a sprawling retelling of D-Day based on 700 interviews with Allies and Germans. The story takes readers into transport planes as paratroopers tumbled out, at a German command post wrought with confusion and disbelief, and finally onto those bloody beaches. I'll be all right, won't I? A mangled soldier asked Albert Eisenberg, a 19-year-old medic faced with so many wounded that he doesn't know where to start. Sure, says Engelberg, and sticks the dying man with morphine. You'll be all right. The magazine followed up in 1974 with more stories from D-Day, including a letter from a woman whose father had been killed on Omaha Beach. I never knew my father, she wrote. For years I hated him because I was tired of mother talking about what the war was like and what a big hero my father was. But her feelings changed after reading The Longest Day in the magazine. My father became real to me. I cried because I love him and he might have loved me. I cried, too, because his life was over before mine ever really began. Yet he gave me my life. Thank you for giving me my father after all these years. Such sentiments help explain why the magazine has resonated for so long among military families. It gives those at home a glimpse of what their loved ones are doing while connecting service members to the world they'd left behind, and to which, if their luck held, they'd be returning. I started writing for the magazine a few years after I got out of the Army in 2005. After my own time overseas, and each story felt like an opportunity to introduce readers to their neighbors, to men and women not so different from the veterans they might have in their own families. I wrote about military chaplains ministering to troops on the battlefield, and dads tending the home front while moms were away at war. I wrote about a stealth fighter pilot and his unlikely friendship with a Serbian man who shot down his plane over the Balkans. After my former squad leader was killed in Afghanistan, I visited his platoon and wrote about the men he'd left behind and their devotion to each other. A magazine's stories often carry subtle and not so subtle undertones of how readers are supposed to feel about a topic. While Reader's Digest has plenty of that through its early years, articles railing against communism, cigarettes, and marijuana, for example, its coverage of service members feels different to me. Stories told without agenda, presented without pageantry. It was the magazine for the grunt, not the general, and the magazine has long celebrated an aspect of military life perhaps least understood by civilians and overlooked by other publications. The day-to-day absurdities of military life, and believe me, there are plenty. Over the decades since the September of 1953 issue, hundreds of thousands of service members and veterans have submitted stories to Humor in Uniform about the peculiarities, frustrations, and inside jokes of military life. Like the one about a soldier who turned 21 on the front lines of the Vietnam War. Amazingly, a birthday cake from his sister found him in his jungle outpost, miles from the nearest base. The case was encased in Tupperware and came with this note: "Dick, when you're finished, can you mail back my container?" Now that's funny. Warren Weedham, the former Marine, learned to appreciate the absurd while trying to survive one of the fiercest battles of the Korean War. On November 27, 1950, Weedham and a buddy spent the night at a listening post on a mountain ridge, out beyond their front lines. With dawn breaking, they heard a cacophony of whistles, bells, and bugles rising up from the other side of the valley. "What the hell is that?" Weedham asked. And they soon saw thousands of Chinese soldiers flooding down the mountainside, heading straight for them. They quickly returned back to their unit. More than 120,000 enemy troops surrounded 30,000 Americans and Allied troops as temperatures plunged to 35 degrees below zero in what became known as the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. The Marines couldn't evacuate their casualties, and doctors wrestled with who could be saved. Those too badly wounded were placed outside the tent, deemed a more humane death, to sleep and not wake up. 2 weeks later, after suffering more than 17,000 injuries and deaths, the Americans and Allied troops broke through the enemy lines and withdrew. Through it all, a magazine was a constant companion, nestled in the front pocket of Weedham's heavy hooded parka. He passed it around with 15 or 20 men reading each copy of his parents' sent. The jokes and funny anecdotes were always a favorite. Humor in a war kept us more natural, more human, he says. Even in the darkest days of combat, there was always somebody playing a trick, doing something stupid, or telling you a joke. There you were getting shot at, and somebody told you a joke, or you read something funny. The magazine, of course, was more than a reliable source of diversion. Its hard-hitting articles and essays were to be trusted. If it was in the Reader's Digest, it had to be true. George Burke was serving in the Army Air Force as a navigator on a V-24 Liberator bomber during World War II, when his plane was shot down on a mission over northern France, 4 days before D-Day. His captors marched him to a prisoner of war camp in Germany, where he was held until the war ended nearly a year later. "He didn't talk about it," says his wife Shirley Garrett, who is now 97 and lives in Clearwater, Florida. "But she saw the effect the war had on him, and the way his mood would drop so low so fast. On weekends, he would often retreat to his in-laws' attics and thumb through neat stacks of old Reader's Digest magazines, which offered him a respite. He could just slip away, read, and not be bothered by anybody," Garrett says. But those bash issues offered more than a refuge in pre-war America. They offered insight into how and why Burke ended up dropping bombs on occupied France. In 1930, he read the article Adolf Hitler, German Hypnotist, about the rise of the Nazis in 1934, making Germany gasproof about German cities preparing for war. And in 1935, where does Hitler get the money? About Germany's massive efforts to rearm. "I just don't understand how the U.S. didn't see this coming," he told Garrett. "It's all right there." Perhaps the most endearing and enduring quality of Reader's Digest has been the role it played during both war and peacetime, as a magazine that best exemplifies home for generations of readers, and a reminder of the familiar, the comforting, and the cherished. It was stories about the life on the farm, relatable personal dramas, profiles of fascinating people. As Warren Weldhound said, Reader's Digest, like no other magazine, linked a lonely American Marine in a foreign country to home. It's a sentiment that Beverly Dotson of Charleston, Arkansas, still subscribed to. In the early 1990s, when her nephew Carl shipped off for months at sea aboard an aircraft carrier, Dotson figured out he could use a dose of the home front, not to mention some humor to lighten his load. For 2 years, from the Pacific to the Persian Gulf, Carl got a monthly rehash of the latest family happenings, along with clippings from Reader's Digest. "I think it's important," Dotson says, "when someone is out there separated from their family, that they know they're not forgotten." In Reader's Digest, she says, with funny, helpful, inspiring articles, understands where we're coming from. Dotson kept up the morale boosting while her son and three nephews served in the Iraq War. It continues today. She just sent another nephew who serves in the Arkansas National Guard a gift prescription. Patriotism, a sense of duty, and a feeling of obligation are the noblest and most necessary qualities of any democratic system. Dwight D. Eisenhower, Reader's Digest, September 1966. Looking to the future, what will affect the next 100 years? Will the next 100 years bring? Our collective future is actually pretty bright. When we look beyond the headlines to the trend lines, we find that humanity overall is healthier, richer, longer lived, better fed, better educated, and safer from war, murder, and accidents than in decades and centuries past. Having documented these changes in two books, I'm often asked, by the way, this is by Steven Pinker, I'm often asked whether I believe in progress. The answer is no. Like the humorist Fran Lebowitz, I don't believe in anything you have to believe in. Though many measures of human well-being, when plotted over time, shows a gratifying increase, though not always and everywhere, it's not because of some force or dialectic or evolutionary law that lifts us ever upward. On the contrary, nature has no regard for our well-being, and often with pandemics and natural disasters, it looks as if it's trying to grind us down. Progress is shorthand for a set of pushbacks and victories wrung out of an unforgiving universe. It is a phenomenon that needs to be explained. The explanation is rationality. When humans set themselves a goal of improving the welfare of their fellow beings, as opposed to other dubious pursuits, such as glory or redemption, they apply their ingenuity to institutions and pool with it others that occasionally succeed. When they retain the successes and take notes of the failures, the benefits can accumulate, and we call the big picture progress. Here are four areas of great progress we have made together. With this in mind, perhaps the future isn't as dire as doomsayers might imagine. We might have hope for a little for the future. We live longer. Beginning in the second half of the 19th century, life expectancy at birth rose from a historic average of around 30 years and is now 72.4 years worldwide, 83 years in the most fortunate countries. This gift of life was not dropped on our doorsteps. It was a hard-won dividend of advances in public health. Motto, saving lives millions at a time. Particularly after the germ theory of disease displaced other casual theories such as miasmas, spirits, conspiracies, and divine retribution. The lifesavers included chlorination and other means of safeguarding drinking water, the lowly toilet and sewer, the control of disease vectors such as mosquitoes and fleas, programs for large-scale vaccination, the promotion of hand washing and developments of basic perinatal care, such as encouraging nursing and body contact. When disease and injuries do strike, advances in medicine keep them from killing as many people as they did in the era of folk healers and barber surgeons. Those advances include antibiotics, antisepsis, anesthesia, transfusions, drugs, and oral rehydration therapy, a salt and sugar solution that stops fatal diarrhea. We have enough to eat. Humanity has always struggled to grow and gather enough calories and protein to feed itself, with famine often just one bad harvest away. But hunger today has been decimated in most of the world. Undernourishment and stunting are in decline, and famines now afflict only the most remote and war-ravaged regions, a problem of not of too little food, but of barriers to get it to the hungry. The additional calories that now exist do not come in a heavily mana or from a cornucopia held by the Abundantia, the Roman goddess of plenty, but from advances in agronomy. These advances include crop rotation to replenish depleted soils, technologies for planting and harvesting such as seed drills, plows, tractors, and combine harvesters, synthetic fertilizer, credited with saving 2.7 billion lives, a transportation and storage network to bring food from farm to table that includes railroads, canals, trucks, granaries, and refrigeration. National international markets that allow a surplus in one area to fill a shortage in another. and a green revolution of the 1960s, which said production and vigorous hybrid crops. We have more money overall. For most of the history, around 90% of humanity lived in what we today would call extreme poverty. In 2020, less than 9% do, an amount still too high, but targeted for elimination in the next decade. The great material enrichment of humanity began with the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. It was literally powered by the capture of energy from coal, oil, wind, and falling water, and later from the sun, the earth, and nuclear fission. The energy was fed into machines that turn heat into work, factories into mass production, and conveyances such as railroads, canals, highways, and container ships. Material technologies, depending on financial ones, particularly banking, finance, and insurance, and neither of these types of technologies could have been parlayed into widespread prosperity without government to enforce contracts, minimize both force and fraud, and smooth out financial lurches by creating central banks with reliable money and invest in wealth-generating public goods such as infrastructure, basic research, and universal education. We fight less. The world has not yet put an end to war, and as the folk singers in 1960 dreamed, but it has dramatically reduced the number of wars and their lethality. From a total of 29.9 battle deaths per 100,000 people in 1950 to just 0.7 in 2019. Peter, Paul, and Mary deserve only some of the credit. More goes to institutions designed to reduce the incentives of nations to go to war, beginning with Immanuel Kant's plan for perpetual peace in 1795. One of them is democracy, which really does reduce the chance of war, presumably because a country cannon fodder is less keen on the pastime than its kings and generals. Another is international trade and investment, which makes it cheaper to buy things than to steal them, and make it unwise for countries to kill their customers and debtors. The European Union, awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012, grew out of a trade organization, the European Coal and Steel Community. Yet another network is a network of international organizations, particularly the United Nations, which knits country into a community, mobilizes peacekeeping forces, immortalizes states, grandfathers in borders, and outlaws and stigmatizes war by providing alternate means of resolving disputes. Brainchild of human ingenuity have also underwritten other historical boosts to well-being, such as safety, leisure, travel, and access to art and entertainment. Though many of today's gadgets and bureaucracies grew organically and were perfected through the trial and error, not one was an accident. People at the time advocated for them with arguments driven by logic and evidence, cost and benefits, cause and effect, and trade-offs between individual advantage and the common good. Our ingenuity will have to be redoubled to deal with the trials we face today, particularly carbon. We'll have to apply brain power to develop technologies that make clean energy cheap, pricing that makes dirty energy expensive, policies that prevent factions from becoming spoilers, and treaties to make the sacrifice global and equitable. But progress consists more than gains in our safety and material well-being. It consists also of gains in how we treat each other, in equality, benevolence, and rights. Many cruel and unjust practices have climbed over the course of history. They include human sacrifice, slavery, despotism, blood sports, eugenism, harems, foot binding, sadistic corporal and capital punishments, the persecution of heretics and dissidents, and the oppression of women and of religious, racial, ethnic, and sexual minorities. None has been extirpated from the first face of the earth. That's an interesting word. Never heard that before. Extirpated from the face of the earth. But when we chart the historical changes, in every case we see descents and in some cases plunges. How do we come to enjoy this progress? Theodore Parker and a century later Martin Luther King Jr. defined a moral arc bending toward justice. But the nature of the arc and its power to pull leftovers of human behavior are mysterious. One can imagine more prosaic pathways. Changing fashions, shaming campaigns, appeals to the heart, popular protest movements, and religious and moralistic crusades. A popular view is that moral progress is advanced through struggle. The powerful never hand over their privileges, which must be wrested from them by the might of the people acting in solidarity. Sound arguments have guided and should guide movements for change. They make the difference between moral force and brute force, between marches for justice and lynch mobs, between human progress and breaking things. And it will be sound arguments both to reveal moral blight and to discover feasible remedies that we need to ensure the moral progress will continue and that abominable practices of today will become as incredible to our descendants as heretic burnings and slave auctions to us. a trusted friend. In celebration of our 100th anniversary, we'd have a group of artists to interpret the phrase a trusted friend in a complicated world. Longtime Reader's Digest contributor C.F. Payne provides the first installment of the series. And we will not have that because it's a visual. And with that, we're going to switch over to Consumer Reports. Now, last week we had a big thing on sleep. We did two issues from the magazine, How to Get a Good Sleep. And we pretty much finished the article, except for the little extras they throw in. And also here they have a toolkit for a good night's sleep. While smart sleep habits like taking time to unwind each night are crucial, optimizing your space can also help set you up for quality slumber. For example, this means a cool, dark, and quiet bedroom. It's also key to remember that pillows and mattresses don't last forever, says sleep expert Rachel Salas, MD, a professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Ditch pillows that no longer support your head and neck, and learn to replace mattresses, and see mattress and pillow ratings, which we can look at, if your bedtime setup could use an upgrade. Here are seven of CR's highly rated sleep products and several other interesting items to check out. Mattress. A mattress that's uncomfortable or sagging from age may leave you struggling to sleep through the night or waking up stiff and sore. Mattress shoppers take note. This brand got high scores for comfort. The avocado green mattress pillow top for $2,100. Pillow. While what's comfiest in a pillow may be a matter of personal preference, it's generally to pick one with solid support that holds up over time. This one outranked the other 17 in our test. Coop Home Goods Premium Adjustable Loft Pillow for $62. Sheets. Almost half the sheets in CR tests shrank so much over time that they no longer fit. And who wants to wake up with a bottom sheet that's all askew? After a year of washing, these still fit a 14-inch mattress. LL Beam Cotton Per Cow, 280 thread count, $149 for the queen size. Air purifier. Allergens like pet dander can cause stuffiness, interfering with sleep. An air purifier can remove many allergens in the air, helping you breathe easier. This is the only CR-testified air purifier that rated a Best Buy. The Blue Air Pure Blue Pure 211 Plus for $300. Weighted blankets. Sleeping under a weighted blanket may help ease anxiety and insomnia in some cases. Interested? Look for one that's 10% of your body weight. This blanket and its cover are both machine washable. Harklet weighted blanket, 15 pounds, $110 to $115. A cooling pad. A cooling pad that sits under a fitted sheet may help the hot sleeper more comfortable on a steamy night. Some can also add heat if needed to warm up arises. Our top-rated cooling pad does both. The Chili Cooler is very expensive, $639 to $1,360. Programmable thermostat. These let you optimize the temperature in your bedroom for sleep. Some can be challenging to set, but this model is easy to operate and has a clear display. Honeywell Home Vision Pro 8000 Touch TH8110R for $145. And more snooze-friendly stuff. Blackout curtains. The persistent glow of street lights can make it hard to fall asleep at night. In the morning, bright rays of sunshine can make it tough to stay asleep. Blackout curtains are lined to keep out all kinds of light that may otherwise seep through and around the regular window coverings. And if you share your bedroom with someone who keeps different hours, the eye mask may prevent light from the hallway, bathroom, or reading lamp from waking you. White noise machine. Hums or street sounds getting in the way of your rest? One of these small devices may be a welcome addition to your bedtime arsenal. Although evidence of their efficacy as a sleep aid is mixed, you can also check out white noise apps or try tuning into radio static instead. And actually, electric alarm clocks have a white noise thing. I have one of those. Aromatherapy. It's a relaxing electronics-free bedtime routine. Doesn't help you unwind enough at night. Try inhaling the scent of lavender via an essential oil or diffuser or a pillow that contains sachets of the flower. This can ease insomnia, according to a 2021 research review. And lastly on this subject, can supplements help you sleep? They may in certain circumstances. Shopper's tip, a seal from a group like the U.S. Pharmacopoeia or ConsumerLab.com provides them some assurance that the products contain what their labels claim. Melatonin. This popular supplement is made from a natural or synthetic version of a hormone melatonin, which signals to your body that it's time to sleep. It can be helpful for older adults who produce less melatonin and those with wonky body clocks, night owls, jet lag travelers, and night shift workers. But a 2013 meta-analysis found that on average, people fall asleep only about 7 minutes faster after taking melatonin. Talk to your doctor before trying this supplement and consider taking it only occasionally. Research is still pending on the safety of long-term use beyond about 3 months. Iron. Iron deficiency is closely linked to a restless leg syndrome, a condition marked by uncomfortable sensations in the limbs and an uncontrollable urge to move them, which can interfere with sleep. Think this might be your issue? Consult a doctor before self-treating. Taking iron could mask a more serious problem. Plus, in people without a deficiency, supplementing could lead to an iron overload, which can damage your organs. Vitamin D. A growing body of evidence suggests a link between low levels of vitamin D and sleep troubles. One study of 89 adults with sleep disorders, published in 2018, found that when people whose vitamin D levels were on the low side, but not deficient, took supplements regularly for 8 weeks, they said they nodded off faster, slept longer, and had better sleep quality than those who received a placebo. But other research has found that certain populations of supplements have no positive effect on sleep, or may worsen it. What to do? Talk to your doctor about vitamin D testing and whether supplements might be worth a try. Valerian. This root has been used for centuries to treat insomnia, and several studies suggest that this supplement may help people fall asleep faster and wake up less often than at night. Their next day grogginess may often occur, but other studies show no benefit. Such mixed findings may be due to the variable quality and instability of active ingredients in valerian, according to a 2020 research review. Be sure to check for a trustworthy seal in the bottle. How to be a winner in today's hot real estate market. Prices are up, inventory is down, and many buyers are feeling desperate. Here's how to navigate the tricky home buying game and also look for something completely different. To sweeten a recent offer on a small house with a few acres here in Texas near Austin, I pledged to keep Jenny and Jeremy, two aging donkeys the seller no longer had use for. Caught up in the adrenaline of the deal, I didn't take into account just how expensive it could be to care for two large animals, a cost I later learned could easily top several $1,000s per donkey per year, especially with their health deteriorates. That same real estate frenzy led me astray in other ways, too. I turned a blind eye to the poor condition of the septic system, the seemingly ancient well, and even the fact that the land survey required to purchase the property had yet to be completed. Worse, no one seemed to know who owned the mineral rights underground. And that's a thing in Texas that can be a real headache if it turns out a company can drill for oil on your property. Worst case scenario, I could be on the hook for about $55,000 in additional cost with all those problems, including the care of the donkeys, a figure that could go far higher. If other issues emerged after purchasing the 50-year-old house and property, my agent Jeffrey Schlenker at Keller Williams really told me. But I was undeterred, raising the question of exactly who was the jackass here. By the way, this article was written by Lisa L. Gill. When she's not shopping for real estate, Lisa covers pharmaceuticals, health insurance, health care costs, and consumer debts for Consumer Reports. While the deal didn't pan out, the seller wound up removing the listing altogether. There's much to be gained from my experience. Since the pandemic began, 50 million people like me have either shopped for a house or attempted to purchase one, according to September 2021 Consumer Reports' nationally represented survey of 2,341 adult Americans. Of those who were looking for a home, only 30% successfully closed on one. To say the U.S. housing market is in overdrive is an understatement. From March 2020 through March 2021, the number of existing homes for sale shrank by about 30%, according to the State of the Nation's Housing 2021 report by the George Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University. And based on data from the U.S. Census, median house prices in the U.S. increased 29% from January 2019 through September 2021. In some markets, including Austin, Miami, Phoenix, and Tampa, Florida, prices increased even more, including Raleigh, North Carolina. For sellers and owners looking to take value out of their homes by refinancing, it's a dream come true. But it could be a nightmare if, like me, you're trying to buy. According to CR survey, the Seal and Deal, 28% of home buyers made offers over asking price, and 44% bid on multiple homes. 7% included escalation clauses saying their offer automatically rises when higher bids are received, while more, 26%, agreed to purchase homes as is, which means without requiring sellers to make fixes. Despite the hurdles, homeownership remains a key way to build wealth, especially for the middle class and people of color, who may have fewer other investments, says Meter Spotzer, Director of Housing Policy at the Consumer Federation of America, a consumer advocacy organization. She estimates that homeownership accounts for about two-thirds of the average family's total assets. here will share tips on how to navigate this new real estate landscape. If you're trying to buy, we'll also explain how you can use the increased value in your present home to make improvements, as well as to look at options for non-traditional dwellings and communities where prices might be more affordable. How to buy a home right now. If you can't afford to pay more than the asking price or to buy a home without contingencies, there are other ways to make your offer stand out. Consider these tips. Search listings on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. In a hot market, deals for homes are often made over the weekend, with listings updated or pending or in contract at the start of the week. Waiting till midweek to search online will spare you the disappointment of latching onto great homes that have already come and gone and help you identify properties that might be languishing, with owners who may be more willing to negotiate on price or other terms. Be aware, too, that there could be issues with the home that have kept others at bay. Then check the listings again starting Thursday evening, because that is when brand new listings are most likely to post, Slanker says. Ask for upfront underwriting. This takes the promise of a mortgage pre-approval, a conditional agreement from a bank to lend you money, a step further, and can be helpful if you're up against buyers who can close quickly because they're making all cash offers, says Wilson Leonard, an agent at Banyan Real Estate in Denver who previously ran a mortgage services company. With upfront underwriting, your financial information, your credit history, debt-to-income ratio, employment, and income is vetted in advance. If you're approved, you get a firm pledge for a loan of a fixed amount, saving several weeks of back and forth with paperwork after you've had an offer on a home accepted. Sweeten your offer where you can. To add value, you might, for example, offer to let the seller stay in the home for a set time after closing, potentially free, if you can manage it. Doing this worked for 8% of people who bought homes during the pandemic, according to CR survey. I tried this gambit myself because the property with the donkeys had been the seller's vacation home for decades. I offered to let them return free for charge for 1 week a year. Another idea, Leonard says, is to agree to let the sellers keep a portion of the money in escrow. The deposit buyers make it part of a real estate deal in the event the transaction falls through. We have clients who say the seller can keep $2,000 to $3,000 if the deal doesn't happen, he says. That's how we compete with all cash deals. Write a love letter. Tell the owners in writing about yourself and why you're interested in their home to help seal the deal, and it is something 22% of people in CR survey said they did. Letters should be heartfelt and clear. You're trying to make a business transaction personal, Shanker says. Consider off-market homes or pocket listings. If you have your eye on a particular home that isn't for sale, ask your agent to contact the owners and make an offer anyway, says Scott Westfall, a real estate consultant and owner of GCP Real Estate in Virginia Beach, or get a jump on the property before it's broadly advertised on an MLS multiple listing service database. Ask your agents whether they are aware of pocket listings. These are listings that are more informally marketed by word of mouth and usually shared among agents working in the same office. Your agent may be able to find these as well if they have access to the private listing network offered by Midwest Real Estate Data and National Service. Don't get discouraged. CR survey found that 44% of home buyers said they had to make offers on two or more homes before one was accepted. 15% made more than five before getting to yes. Get smart about inspections. 26% of buyers in CR survey bought a home as is, but as you consider that only if you have deep pockets. Surprise fixes can be costly. For example, a new well can cost tens of thousands of dollars. Most people buying a home should have it inspected by a professional. Look one through organizations such as American Society of Home Inspectors or the National Academy of Building Inspection Engineers. Also ask friends or family for recommendations. And if the inspection does not include it, check for mold, contaminants in the water, and radon, a colorless, odorless, radioactive gas that can cause lung cancer. Here's what's most important and what is less so. Very important. Condition of the foundation. Condition of plumbing, septic tanks, and wells. Age and condition of electrical wiring and circuit breakers and boxes. Age and condition of water heater and heating and cooling systems. Age and condition of the roof. Less critical, age of the appliances. Condition of exterior and interior paint. Condition of exterior fencing, outbuildings, and landscaping. Age of lighting, bath, and kitchen fixtures. And the age of bath and kitchen cabinets. Alternative paths to homeownership. After repeatedly coming up all against all cash offers, off buyers willing to offer go inspections, my search for a home in Texas was going nowhere fast. So I started looking for something different. Here are some options I found for people who might not be looking for just a new home, but also a new way of life. Community living. At any new community opening soon in Austin, there are no bidding wars. Instead, buyers are refused on a first-come, first-served basis. You can put down as little as $4,995 toward the purchase of a futuristic pod made of skyscraper glass and metal. The pods can be bought for individually or in multiples and configured in numerous ways. When you buy it new, that's NEU, you're not buying the pods but shares in a co-op. It's the idea that people living here own the community, says Jonathan Jenkins, CEO of New, adding that they are priced for retirees or people on single incomes. I toured a 320-square-foot model of a studio starter pod. Even with its small footprint, the home feels spacious, with built-in cabinets and closets, a Murphy bed, and a full kitchen. Bonus, fewer cars. New will limit the gas-powered vehicles by using a community car-sharing program. Such sustainable living is part of what's driving a larger movement across the U.S., known as intentional living, groups of people who share the same values or vision and purchase homes to live together in communities. Another example is PDX Commons in Portland, Oregon, an environmentally conscious condo community for those in the last third of their life. It was co-founded for people who wanted to live among others dedicated to aging, well at home in a supportive community near stores, parks, and cafes. To join, members purchase a condo unit with 1 to 3 bedrooms and share a communal kitchen and other areas. A 2-bedroom, 2-bath condo sold last March for $560,000. There are at least 40,000 intentional communities across the U.S., says Cynthia Tina, co-director of the Foundation for Intentional Community, a nonprofit that supports these groups throughout the U.S. Go to its website at ic.org to search for something similar. Pros and cons for community living. The pros: support, sharing values, resources, and responsibilities, fosters connection with others. Financing. Conventional mortgage can typically be obtained. Green. Carbon footprint can be smaller. Requirements. Level of community engagement may not suit everyone. Proximity. Neighbors may live very close to one another. And rules. If you sell, the new owner will probably have to agree to the community's rules. Community gardening. Village Hearth Co-Housing in Durham, North Carolina, which I am very familiar with, which builds itself as a 55-plus intentional community for LGBTQ's friends and allies, turned its usual Friday half hour into a planning session last spring. And actually, I've seen this community, and I've actually walked through it. It's extremely charming, and it really is. It's mainly targeted toward the gay community. However, there are also people who are just, and Durham has a tendency to have somewhat liberal leaning, so it's not unusual, but it is really a great community. Tiny houses. What has been a fringe curiosity for more than a decade, mostly suited for do-it-yourselfers who want to live in smaller spaces, tiny houses have gone mainstream, even have a foot in the luxury market. For a house to be considered tiny, it is typically 400 square feet or less, compared with the average American home of about 2,300 square feet. High-end builders have gotten on board with designer-quality homes, such as the 26-foot-long, 8.5-wide-foot model, Napa model from Mint Tiny House Company in Vancouver, Canada. Once you add things like a drawer dishwasher, a washer-dryer combo, and a tiled shower, glass doors, it costs about $100,000. Then there's a 375-foot Escher tiny house, a new frontier design in Nashville, Tennessee. It features dark wood finishes and floors, 2 bedrooms, a chef's kitchen, a walk-in closet, a custom tile shower, and a garage door-like wall that opens to the outdoors, and prices begin at $209,000. Prefab and do-it-yourself kits are also options. One example, the 180-square-foot Vista Boho home from Wisconsin builder Escape. Originally a joint project with IKEA, the house starts at $46,000 and delivered on a flatbed truck. New technologies can make do-it-yourself home building less complicated. Boxable in Las Vegas makes a 375-foot, $49,500 foldable home, replete with fixtures, finishes, and electrical that literally unfolds. It can be put together in a day with walls and floors that lock into place. The biggest hurdle that might be where to put a tiny house if you don't own land or have a spot reserved in a tiny house community. Zoning, building codes, and permitting still a factor in traditional homes, though that's changing. In early 2022, Oakland, California will allow tiny houses to be primary residences on private property. Last year, Evanston, Illinois approved zoning for tiny efficiency houses as primary dwellings. Meanwhile, here in Texas, I found custom home builder Fine Grain Designs in Austin after renting a tiny house the owner and his wife had built. I'd fallen in love with the poured concrete countertops, tub-a-tiled bath, oak floors, and hand-cranked windows, cubby storage, and vaulted ceiling. Now I just need a place to put it. Tiny house pros and cons. The pros: savings, less expensive than traditional homes. Sustainability. Sustainability reduced energy costs because of the smaller footprint. Portability. Some homes are built on trailers. Financing. Some homes may qualify for recreational vehicle loans. The cons. Outlook. Home might not increase in value and cannot be borrowed against. Financing. Conventional 30-year mortgage not available. An RV loan or other financing won't qualify for federal tax break or loan protection. Storage. Limited storage space, additional storage you may be needed. Placement. Many localities do not present tiny houses as primary residence. And all the comfort of home. The Escher House from New Frontier Design has a tricked-out kitchen, a sink-side master bedroom, and a stylish design bathroom, and it's on wheels so you can go mobile. And they have a picture of it here, and it actually looks like a trailer. It's actually kind of attractive, but it also kind of cheap-looking, to be honest with you. How to tap your home's value. If buying a new home isn't cards for you, but you're itching for a change, a new kitchen, a dedicated workspace, and need a lump sum of money to do it, now would be the time to tap the value you have in your house, especially if it's worth more than when you first bought it. A common way to do this is by taking out a home equity loan. Another is by doing what's called a cash-out refinance, a type of new mortgage that monetizes the equity you have in your home, says Robert Heck, a vice president of mortgage services for Morty, an online residential mortgage broker and consultant firm. Interest on these mortgages is typically lower than on home equity loans. Whereas a regular refinance replaces your current mortgage with a new one for the same balance, a cash-out refinance replaces your mortgage with a new one for more than you presently owe, with difference going to you in cash. Rising real estate values have made cash-out refinance a useful tool for more people. In the second quarter of 2021, the average homeowner gained about $51,000 in equity. Homes in the West saw large bumps, in Idaho $97,000, Washington $102,000, Los Angeles $116,000, according to figures by CoreLogic, a real estate industry research firm. In the second quarter of 2021 alone, homeowners withdrew $54 billion in cash outs, according to Freddie Mac, the Federal Home Loans Mortgage Corp. Home lending pros recommend that you use the money you extract from a cash out refinance very carefully. That includes paying for upgrades that increase the home's resale value, paying down more expensive debt, such as credit cards, or beefing up emergency or retirement savings. You should use the money only for a profitable purchase, says Reverend Dr. Charles Butler, who helps run a nonprofit that offers housing counseling and other community empowerment programs and is based in New York City. You're ultimately going to need to pay the new larger mortgage back. A couple of caveats. While processes of applying for a cash-out refinance is basically identical to that of a regular refi, typical banks won't do it if you have less than 20% equity, says Westfall at GCP Real Estate, and you should expect to see some additional refinancing costs that you won't face with a regular refi. Additionally, nationally, the average closing cost for a single-family residential refinance were $3,400 last year, according to figures from Closing Corp, a real estate industry tracking firm. But cash-out refi lenders may impose slightly higher interest rates on new loans, perhaps 0.125 to 0.25% more than they do for regular refis. Even so, a cash-out refinance might give you a lower interest rate if you bought your home when mortgage rates were much higher. Consider a refi with cash-out if you have more than 20% equity in your home, your home's value has increased since you purchased the home, you plan to use the funds to reinvest in the home or to pay down expensive debt, such as credit cards. You can ensure favorable new terms on a mortgage at a lower interest rate and lower monthly payments. Just a teaser for next week. The lead article in Consumer Reports for next week that we're going to read is Dark Chocolate Really Good For You? What's new, healthier, and tastier, and the brands to try if you only like milk chocolate? So lick your lips and get ready for next week. And now for the road report. Car parts thefts rise sharply. Catalytic converter thefts are on the rise from about $100 a month on average in 2018 to more than $1,200 a month in 2020. The trend is fueled by rising prices for the precious metals, platinum, rhodium, and palladium, and this emission scrubbing equipment found in all gasoline-powered vehicles. Some hybrid models, such as the Toyota Prius, are at greater risk due to the high scrap value of their converters, which can exceed $1,000, according to the marketplace website AutoCatalystMarket.com. To deter theft, park in a secured garage or a well-lit area. If you park overnight in a driveway, install motion-sensitive lights. A catalytic converter shield can thwart thieves, but some cost $300 or more and require a pro to install. And make sure your car comes with all the features it's supposed to have. Your new car might not have all the features you've been promised. Some automakers are leaving out equipment due to ongoing chip shortage. For example, heated seats and steering wheels are not available in some Chevrolets. Some Cadillacs have been sold without the Super Cruise Active Driver Assist. And BMW says the availability of wireless phone charging is temporarily limited. Check that any new car you buy has the features it's supposed to have, or that they will be installed free when the shortage is over. And the vital statistic is 23% overall reduction in automobile CO2 emissions since 2004. It's clear that the EPA's strong greenhouse gas emission standards work, says Chris Harto, senior policy analyst at CR. Now the EPA must finalize its next round of standards to cut emissions further. And should I pay extra for synthetic oil? Probably not. Synthetic oil can add $30 or more to the cost of an oil change. CR's chief mechanic, John Ibbotson, says you should use the type of oil your owner manual calls for. Since most cars don't require synthetic oil, he says, most owners don't need it. He adds, however, that switching from conventional motor oil to synthetic can make sense for people who drive in extreme hot or cold climates or do a lot of towing. Synthetic oil is designed to improve lubrication, and it can be better addressed than demands those driving conditions put on the engine. But if your car came from the factory with a conventional oil and your driving isn't demanding, save the money and stick with your regular oil. And Toyota is recalling more than 227,000 Camry sedans from 2018 and 2019 model years to fix a faulty part in the vehicle's braking system that could cause sudden loss of braking power to potentially lead to a crash. Although the brakes will still work if the part malfunctions, they may require increased force to engage. Toyota dealerships will repair or replace the faulty part free of charge. And a quick joke. Nostalgia is the key to a lasting marriage. British politician Tony Benn had known Caroline DeCamp only 9 days when he proposed to her on a park bench in Oxford. After she said yes, Benn bought the bench, put it in their garden. They were married for 51 years. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.